This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's our Week in Review. Massachusetts, back in a pitched battle with the coronavirus, hits a heartbreaking milestone this week with 10,000 deaths due to the pandemic.
We are in the midst of what was expected and anticipated by a lot of folks in the public health and epidemiological community last spring, which is that there would be an echo associated with this and it would land in the fall.
And the MBTA becomes the latest economic casualty, proposing cuts that could mark a tectonic shift in transportation.
The general manager said these cuts are not permanent, and they spent some time talking about building back, but you don't turn on service like a tap. So this is not something that we're going to just recover from.
Meanwhile, the presidential election was called, but the Trump administration will not start the transfer of power.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. Right. We're ready. The world is watching.
While the presumed president-elect fights the headwinds.
We are already beginning the transition. We're well underway. And the ability for the administration in any way by failure to recognize this our win does not change the dynamic at all in what we're able to do.
We heard there Governor Charlie Baker, Jared Johnson of Transit Matters, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and President-elect Joe Biden as we review a week when we were stuck in place. Join our panelists to debrief all of it and to try to figure out how we can keep moving forward. We'll start today with the presidency. Call with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us on the line are former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift and WBUR reporter Callum Borchers. Callum, Jane Swift, welcome back.
Thank you.
Great to be with you, Tiziana, and hello, Governor.
And Governor Swift, okay with you if I call you Jane for today?
Oh, I would love that. Are you going to call Callum Governor?
I can if that would
you
make
this
thing
You probably don't want
the job
right now, Callum.
I never even was in student government, never mind real government. So I'm afraid okay. I'm not worthy of the title, but glad to be with you both.
All right, then we'll go by Callum and Jane.
All
there
right.
we go. And let's dive right in here. I do want to start with the presidency. You know, last time we reviewed the week, which was just a week ago, we didn't have a president-elect. Since then, all five media outlets have called the race for Joe Biden. We still don't have a transition. It's kind of the ultimate stuck in place. And I want to know, what is at stake for the people of the Commonwealth in a delayed transition, Jane?
So I would just have a slight disagreement. You know, my dad used to tell me that the voters are really smart. And by having elected as a president-elect the former vice president, we actually have a transition going on. It's just that there has not been a formal recognition of it, and it has not been sanctioned by the GSA, which I think is deeply unfortunate and will not reflect well, frankly, on the Trump administration or the president and those who are enabling him in this moment. But fortunately, the Biden campaign and President-elect Biden have and understand what it takes to begin to assemble an administration. And by all appearances are beginning to do that. And slowly, far too slowly, we are starting to see him we're starting to see some Republicans start to acknowledge that he needs access to the levers of power.
So, Callum, let me play a couple of pieces of sound for you here. To Jane's point about what this looks like in the long term for the president, this is President-elect Joe Biden earlier this week speaking to reporters in Wilmington, Delaware, talking about Donald Trump's reluctance to concede the race.
I just think it's an embarrassment, quite frankly. The only thing that... How can I say this tactfully? I think it will not help the president's legacy.
And then also to Jane's point, we are seeing some Republicans now sort of begin to speak up. And this one was particularly remarkable. This is Governor Baker condemning the president's challenge to the election results earlier this week.
I'm dismayed to hear the baseless claims coming from the president, from his team, and from many other elected Republican officials in Washington. This latest move to employ the Department of Justice in all of this is so wildly inappropriate. And stalling an orderly transition process, especially at a time like this, is equally unacceptable.
Okay, so that's the point on one side, Callum, but now we've got the counterpoint. Data from The Economist and YouGov suggests that 86% of people who voted for Donald Trump don't believe Joe Biden won. So let's just count that out. 1.15 million people in the Commonwealth voted for Donald Trump. So that would come out to something about roughly 1 million Massachusetts voters who might not believe that Joe Biden's tenure as president, should he be certified, which is pretty likely, is going to be legitimate. What do we do about that as a state?
I mean, I think what I'm thinking about, Tiziana, is just all the constituents here in Massachusetts who are hurting right now during a global pandemic. And what they're hoping for is that this new Congress is going to be able to first pass a new coronavirus stimulus package and get them some relief, and then hopefully work together in a more cooperative way than we've seen in Washington in recent years. And so I think that the biggest effect for Massachusetts just may be that, you know, this period of resisting the lawful transition of power just could set up kind of an acrimonious tone in Washington, even more than we've already had. You know, I'm thinking of that news conference with the president-elect that you played some tape of a moment ago, Tiziana. You and I were watching that together, although, you know, remotely. And at the end, yeah, you remember, Joe Biden was asked, you know, well, what about these lawmakers who refuse to recognize you? And he said, well, they will, right? And he sort of grinned and kind of shrugged it off. But it still is it's a tough way to start a new term. And so, you know, here in Massachusetts, of course, we have an all-Democratic congressional delegation. And I think the concern is that when they all go back to Washington, are they really going to be able to work together when this transition period has been so testy?
So, Jane and Callum, I'm going to go straight to the phones. 800-423-8255. We've got George on the line from Duxbury. George, go ahead.
Yeah, my name's George, and I'm a Massachusetts resident, lifelong, an attorney in Massachusetts, actually, and I've been a lifelong Republican. And this entire Trump presidency has been an embarrassment, frankly. And his failure to turn over, peacefully transition the reins of power, is unacceptable. I can't even imagine myself voting Republican again, ever.
Thanks for the call, George. And Jane Swift, do you think we're going to hear? I mean, listen, keeping this at the local level, which is, I think, where we want to be, we know that there is a fissure in the state Republican Party between those who have turned the state Republican Party towards Donald Trump and Republicans who have not gone there. Now you hear somebody like George just now. What does that mean for the future of Republicanism in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
So I think it's the future of the Republican Party, frankly. I think it's the future of the Commonwealth. I think it's the future of the country. Listen, I am extremely sympathetic to George. I have three daughters. One of them would never be a Republican. Two of them are more moderate in their views. They will not consider voting Republican or calling themselves a Republican in the party of Donald Trump. So I appreciate that. I have chosen to continue to be a Republican because I believe it's incredibly important to pull the country back to the center. And the only way you do that is to pull the leadership of your party back to the center, back to, you know, you said, who's going to do that healing? More people who are courageous enough to stand up to their party when what their party leaders do is not in the best interest of their country, their district, the people that they represent. And that's what we need more of. And we need it from both parties. And I would just say that the members of the congressional delegation in Massachusetts should follow Joe Biden's lead. President-elect Biden has not responded tit for tat to the provocation of Donald Trump, because frankly, you cannot out-Trump Trump. And the healing has to start by one person deciding to be bigger and offer a olive branch to the other side and offer to start meeting people halfway. And by President-elect Biden methodically forming a cabinet, not calling names, not raising the temperature, I think that's the beginning of starting that process.
You are listening to Radio Boston's Week in Review with Jane Swift and Callum Borchers. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. So, Callum, you had mentioned the delegation. Jane Swift just mentioned it. We talked to three members of the delegation this week. One was Seth Moulton. He reacted to the administration's position, especially he had strong words in reaction to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, which we heard, you know, with this smooth transition to a Trump administration that we heard earlier. Here's Seth Moulton.
I think it's despicable and it's dangerous. It's dangerous because it's a terrible precedent to set for the rest of the world. And let's not forget, there are young men and women risking their lives out there today, all around the globe, fighting fundamentally for our democratic values. And the Secretary of State just made their job a lot harder.
So that is not an olive branch, Callum. Those are strong words. And we are sending a Democratic congressional delegation back to Washington in January. How to build bridges now, especially given the rifts in the... I mean, again, we had 1.15 million people in the Commonwealth vote for Donald Trump. How to do what Jane Swift was just talking about.
Well, it's such a good question, and I think you heard sort of the fragility from our caller George there, who is one of those Republicans who didn't vote for President Trump, but it would be inclined to vote Republican and is feeling turned off. And one of the things that I'm concerned about as a political observer, Tiziana, is whether we're in danger of losing some of that robust two-party debate that we have on Beacon Hill. I mean, yes, this is a very blue state. We know that, and Democrats dominate in the legislature. But, of course, we have a long history of electing Republicans. Governors, including Governor Swift, right, who we have right along with us, and we have a Republican governor right now. And so, you know, I think one of the concerns is do you turn off too many Republican voters in Massachusetts and end up in essentially kind of a one-party system on Beacon Hill? And I think that we would lose something in that scenario where you don't have maybe that robust exchange of ideas when you have two parties sort of as checks and balances on each other in our state government.
So let's turn to the State House, Beacon Hill. That's a great transition for us because there was a lot going on this week as the State House, our local Congress, struggled with a $46 billion, there's a big difference with that extra zero, budget that they passed last night, 6 months after they would normally be taking it up due to the coronavirus. I'm going to transition here by talking about the Dome Amendment, which did not pass. It was one of 777 amendments to the budget considered. It was offered by Representative Mindy Dohm, and it would have limited Governor Baker to appointing someone of the same party if a sitting member of Congress gets pulled up to a new Biden administration. It did not pass, and it clearly seems like it was targeted at Elizabeth Warren's Senate seat, given the rumors of Senator Warren maybe being in a Biden administration. But to that point, is that a good idea, to disenfranchise Republicans? Again, it didn't pass, but should it have, and is proposing it a good idea, saying to a sitting governor, you can't enfranchise your party if you're given this right to appoint? Governor Swift, Jane Swift.
Well, it's certainly not a good idea to do it as an outside section of a budget. And I'm glad the House did not approach it that way. It's certainly not a good idea for the Massachusetts legislature to change the rules every time there is an opening to be had. If there is a better way to approach open seats, then we should have that debate in the light of day, and we should have it irregardless of what is going on in the context of a particular seat and the self-interest of a particular politician or several dozen. And so I don't think this passed what we used to call the smell test. I don't know if they use that anymore. That was a long time ago when I was participating in budget debates, but it didn't pass the smell test. You can't sort of do something to facilitate the ambitions of one elected official that would then set off a domino effect to help many other ambitious elected officials. So no, it wasn't good government. It wasn't good process. And if we are going to have a debate, let's have it in some non-transition period.
So that was one amendment. Yeah, no, jump in.
Just to build on what the governor is saying, you know, I think there's a broader context here of a couple of political debates right now centered on, do we change the rules, right? I mean, we have, you know, in Washington right now, you have a debate about whether or not Democrats should change the number of Supreme Court justices, right? Packing the court is one of the big debates right now. Or do you do away with the Electoral College system because you don't like the result that that has turned out in some recent elections? We saw it a little bit on a smaller scale here in Massachusetts. It's on the ballot question about ranked choice voting, right? And that was seen as kind of a progressive reform in a blue state. And it didn't pass here, by the way, right? You had enough of a traditional streak in Massachusetts that voters said, pump the brakes. I'm not ready to change the system in that way. And so I think that's something for Democrats to be mindful of right now, is whether there's an appetite in the electorate to change some of these longstanding rules, even if recent history hasn't favored them.
I want to pick up a call here, 800-423-8255. We've got Jerry on the line from Woods Hole. Jerry, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering what in Massachusetts, which has been Democratic for as long as I can remember, what are we doing? And I count myself as one of them. So what are we doing, the Senate, what are you doing to listen to those, that many people? President Trump got the second most votes for president in history. Thank God it was Joe Biden that got number one. But what are we doing to listen to those other 70 million people? Something like, what are we doing to listen to them? This has to be a wake-up call.
Thanks for that, Jerry. Let me turn it back to Jane. Let me turn to you. How, you know, you spent time listening as an elected official. We need formal and informal listening. We're also going to have other listeners to that call who are going to say, and we've heard this from our callers these last couple of weeks on the show, I don't want to listen to a voter for President Trump because his agenda was so threatening to who I am. So how do we get past this?
Well, first of all, if you haven't read Sarah Smarsh's book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. I'm from North Adams. I'm from the western part of the state, which looks a lot like the kinds of places that people vote for Donald Trump. And when I read that book, it resonated a lot with me. I think we do need to listen to each other. I think that, you know, I've had this conversation with my daughters and with other folks. If you enter a discussion with the belief that anyone who voted for Donald Trump is a bad person, we will never close these divides. There are good people who, for reasons we need to better understand, voted for Donald Trump. And I realize when I say that, there are also people for whom some of the comments and actions that Donald Trump has taken that are racist and hurtful make even me saying we should listen to people who voted for him very difficult for them personally. Our country has to figure out a way to come together. And I believe that work started and starts with this new administration, not by rejecting everybody who didn't vote the same way. And I think, again, President-elect has said he's the president of all the people. Understanding why people think differently than you and vote differently from you, I think, is incredibly American.
So, Callum and Jane, there is one more subject I want to get in at the Commonwealth level before we go to a break. Coming back to the State House and the budget, last night the House passed an amendment that would codify more securely abortion rights into law in the Commonwealth. The key provisions, a couple of key ones. First, allowing abortions after 24 weeks in cases of, quote, fatal fetal anomalies, end quote. It also lowers the age at which a woman or a girl can get an abortion without parental consent from 18 to 16. The numbers here, it passed 108 to 49. WBUR's Steve Brown has told us he thinks it's likely to pass in the Senate, too. Callum, doesn't seem like a surprise, but it certainly seems momentous.
It does. And, you know, it's very telling for the moment that we're in, right? Of course, the backdrop here is the swearing in of Justice Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, right? There's this broad concern among abortion rights activists that the Supreme Court could at some point overturn Roe v. Wade, which they feel is somewhat fragile. And so I think you see some states, especially blue states like Massachusetts, trying to reinforce those rights at the state level. And it's interesting. I had sort of a background conversation with a congressional lawmaker recently, Tiziana, on this subject. And that person said that Congress, Democrats in Congress, should perhaps attempt to do something similar. In other words, don't just rely on legal precedent for the rights that you're trying to protect. They would be safer if you could write them into law. And so I'm curious whether that's something we might see go from, you know, the State House here to Capitol Hill in the coming months.
And Jane, I want to ask you one question on this, too, because if a bill like this passes both houses in Beacon Hill, goes to Charlie Baker, does it put him in a pickle? He doesn't usually comment on legislation he might soon have to sign. It seems like it could both further expose the fault lines between him and his party on the one hand, or between him and an independent base who might support him in a future reelection campaign on the other.
So I think Charlie has been very clear about his position on social issues. I don't think it puts him in a pickle. I think the mistake is when we try to make the argument that women's votes are all about abortion. And frankly, I think that it's important that this bill passed. I think we presuppose what's going to happen in the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure, frankly, that is always correct in thinking we know how certain justices are going to act before they do, and that's perhaps a topic for another session on Radio Boston when we're not quite so packed with set issues. But The thing that I would say is the mother of three daughters who, yes, care about that issue, there's a lot more work to do for underrepresented groups and for equity and inclusion and diversity than abortion.
We're talking about the coronavirus in this segment, its second surge here in the Commonwealth, what we can do to handle it and what comes next. You know, we kind of framed this up this week as being stuck in place, and it does feel like deja vu all over again with the daily infection numbers. We're hovering often above 2,000 now. That's becoming a more familiar occurrence again. I do want to be responsible here and also mark the magnitude of where we are. So I want to ask you both, what should our collective reaction be at this moment? And let's use a scale from sort of take a deep breath, we knew this would happen, all the way to, dear God, help us. You know, where are we, Callum?
I guess I'm more on the deep breath side of the spectrum, but to your point, Tiziana, we don't want to minimize the seriousness of what's going on here. But I do think the key difference is we are better prepared for this second wave than we were for the first. I mean, I'm thinking about how at the outset there was a shortage of really basic stuff like masks, for example. And I feel like every surface in my house now has a mask that I can grab when I need to go out the door for something. So we have access to basic PPE in a way that we didn't, 6 and 8 months ago. And we're also learning how to treat the virus better. We don't have that vaccine yet, and it'll be a while even after that before it's readily available to the whole general public. But I think we've made significant progress in recent months in a way that should bring us at least some comfort as we work through this second wave.
Jane, I'm going to play some sound for you to Callum's point before I turn to you. This is Governor Baker at a press conference yesterday, underscoring that we are better prepared now.
We're nowhere near the uncharted territory we were at in the spring. Nowhere near it. Nowhere. We are definitely dealing with a surge that we talked about throughout the summer and the beginning of the fall, and we're currently the largest per capita tester in the United States.
So where do you see us with that in mind on this continuum I was asking about?
So I agree. I think we are better prepared. I think everybody should wear a mask. I think we better understand what we know and what we don't know. We understand this is airborne. I think most people understand how masks do and don't protect us. I will say I'm not sure we have it all nailed. I dare anybody to find a container of Clorox wipes somewhere and then try to buy two at a time. Maybe only the other women or Walmart shoppers out there will understand what I'm saying, but it's nearly still impossible to do that. So, you know, there are still some challenges. I think the biggest challenge is in trying to get people to act collectively when the public health mandates make sense for a public health policy. And sometimes when you apply them individually, they don't make as much sense. And so there has got to be some clear communication and articulation of sort of why do we do certain things that seem, you know, not to make sense when you look at them in a micro level, but actually they do make sense as broad-based public policy.
1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation and tell us where you are on this continuum. Are you feeling like, yeah, we knew we were going to be here, you know, take a deep breath, or are you at the point where you're scared, where you're worried about this second surge? And how is it affecting how you're thinking about everything that comes forward as the winter comes, as we talk about whether to be back in schools, as we think about Thanksgiving, et cetera? Callum, we've been watching this as a station, right? We've all been reporting on this since last spring. One of the things that I do want to point out is we are back to the kind of infection numbers, but we are not back to the level of death that we saw on the scale last spring. We're in the 20 to 30 deaths per day range now. Then we were in triple digits. Every death is a tragedy, and I do not want to be disrespectful of that or underplay it, but we do seem to be in a place where it is a less life-threatening virus than it was before. Do we think that can hold?
I think it can hold, but I think that the concern that Jane raised earlier is the right one, which is perhaps that sense of complacency, you know, that we get too satisfied with our progress and sort of take our foot off the gas when it comes to doing simple things like making sure that we're wearing our masks and we're washing our hands and we're disinfecting surfaces. But I think that we have learned in recent months how to treat the virus more effectively, and we're also testing more, as we heard Governor Baker say earlier, and that means that we're detecting infections earlier, and of course, the sooner you catch it, the more progress that you can make. So I'm encouraged by what we see, but I just think it's really important to reinforce. Jane made a terrific point about, you know, keeping in mind other people. I was thinking about my own small children who were going to preschool this year, for example, Tiziana, and the school had said that, you know, those little kids don't have to wear masks when they come to school. The teachers will, but the kids don't because they're so little and it might be hard. But most of the families sort of collectively decided, you know what, we are going to teach our little ones to wear masks because we want to protect the teachers too, you know. And so even if it may be kind of uncomfortable and annoying for like a 3- and 4-year-old to have to do that, to look out for other people, because we know that the masks not only protect yourself, but they also help protect other people around you. I think that kind of collective conscience is what we need right now.
Well, and to this point about both complacency and protective behavior that you guys are talking about, the governor spoke this afternoon, and here's what he was talking about what everyone needs to do right now to stop the spread.
If you're not around members of your immediate family, and I mean your immediate family, you should wear a mask, indoors and outdoors. I know that sounds aggressive, but the simple truth is this expansion of people's social circles and this desire to get back to something like normal is a big part of what's driving case growth and ultimately hospitalizations, not just here in Massachusetts, but across the country.
How much of an issue is compliance with mask wearing and social distancing here in the Commonwealth, do we think, on a day-to-day basis, Jane?
So I don't know how to measure that, but I will say you can go out and you can look around, right? And in Berkshire County, about 3 weeks ago, I went to, I'm not going to say which drugstore, and for the first time in a long time, there were a lot of people sitting right outside of the pharmacy, not wearing masks. It was the first time I had seen it, and they were sitting right by the door. They weren't socially distanced. And so it seemed like there had been this sort of change. I don't know, again, right, to Calum's point, I don't know if it was complacency. I don't know if folks just assumed, hey, I'm outside, so the fact that I'm sitting next to somebody doesn't matter. And again, like, this is really hard messaging to get right all the time. So, and frankly, there are little memes, you know, when somebody's on the television saying, oh, don't play your music too loud at Thanksgiving. I understand the point, but I think that that then just becomes a distraction to the larger point of it's an airborne virus, and to the degree that you can not spread your air too widely, you're going to protect other people.
I want to go to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We've got Kira on the line from Concord. Kira, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Tiziana, and hi to your guests, too. And my apologies for not addressing their names. I kind of came in, like, a little past the time where everyone was being introduced and everything. On a simple note, okay, because this is such a unprecedentedly difficult time for all of us. And I've been a CNA for about, off and on now, for about 21 plus years. And I had to take some time, and it's really okay, because I just realized that it just, I don't think I'm quite made out for these times. I don't know how many people of us are really either. But having said that, though, I will say that the nurses, the doctors, the health aides, CNAs, everyone is doing everything they can. And it is going to get better. It is so essential for all of us at this time to remember the simple things like our fresh air that we can breathe, the water that we drink and bathe in. And I'm just moved by so many things right now. And so pardon me for being a little...
It's okay, Kira, but I am going to take it back from you now. Yeah. And how deeply you feel about this really does come across. I'm glad that you called. Calum, you know, we are headed into Thanksgiving. One of the things we've been talking about in my household is where we focus on gratitude now in this really challenging time. And I sometimes wonder, you know, just thinking about the questions I was setting up to ask today, are we focusing on the healing enough as we deal with the challenges that are right in front of us? How do we think about that as a community?
These are great questions. And of course, you know, to Kira's point, when you do sort of need a moment to kind of catch your breath and take a break from, you know, the pressures of your life, a holiday like Thanksgiving, where you gather with friends and family, is often the way to do that. And that's going to look different this year. And that's hard. But I think that one of the, if we look for a silver lining here, it may be this, which is that think about how openly and think of the candor it took for Kira to call up and talk about sort of needing to take a break. You know, I mean, I think that in general, we've become much more open talking about our mental health needs, our emotional needs during this pandemic. I think that we've seen a huge spike in telehealth services during this period. And a lot of the people using telehealth services are using it for mental health services. I think that that is one of the positive changes that has come out of this period.
I want to grab one more call here on this subject. We've got Chris on the line from Worcester. Chris, go ahead.
How you doing? I was calling. I was really concerned about the lack of guidance from OSHA. I work in the construction industry, and we're working there on sewer lines, and there's really no guidance on what the proper PPE is, or whether COVID could travel through the sewers, or anything like that. I was wondering why there's no guidance from OSHA.
Thanks for that, Chris. And just for listeners, that's Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Jane, this seems like a good one for you to take before we go to break.
So I will find the exact link and I'll share it with you so that WBUR can put it up on their website. But there is actually some great information on the CDC website. You have to dig around and find it. But I had some friends reach out to me who are dental assistants and dental hygienists a couple of months ago, who were worried about specific work-related protections. And I was able to point them to the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, actually does have some industry-specific workplace guidance that you can look at, Chris. and I didn't specifically look to see by construction workers in sort of sewer. So I assume you're either in excavation or you might be in HVAC if you're working with underground plumbing. But there is some good guidance there.
We're going to talk about proposed deep cuts to the T in this segment. Listeners, you can call with your thoughts. Are you taking the T? Are you not? Are you worried about the long-term impact of these cuts? If your service is cut, what does it mean for you? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm going to dive right in here with some sound about why this is happening. This is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak earlier this week announcing these proposed cuts.
The T is still only transporting about 330,000 trips on an average weekday, but it's running roughly the same level of service as it ran to serve 1.26 million trips prior to the pandemic. This level of service delivery, along with the loss in revenue, is not sustainable.
So we knew, right? We knew the T's been hurting since last spring. But Callum, were you surprised by the depth of these proposed cuts?
I thought that the way the MBTA framed the cut proposals was to stress that, well, we're able to preserve a lot of the essential services, right? They said, well, about 82% of the essential weekday trips are being preserved. But think about that figure. I mean, if we flip it around, that basically means almost 20%. It's almost one in five essential weekday trips would be eliminated. That's pretty deep when you think about it, because we're not just talking about, weekend evenings here. We're talking about basic services that a lot of essential workers rely on to get to work every day.
So, Jane, I want to play Jim Aloisi, who's a former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation, board member of the group Transit Matters. He was on Radio Boston on Tuesday, and he took it to Governor Baker about this.
The governor runs the T. I mean, Steve Poftak runs the T day-to-day, but the governor controls it. The governor can move and act tomorrow to raise net new revenue for the T if he wanted to. Why doesn't he?
Is that fair?
So sometimes, and I know Jim, he and I actually go back 30 years. Sometimes it's good to be out of government rather than in government. it's fair and it's unfair. Listen, the impacts, this is where the virus and the impacts of it, you know, I work a lot in education. This is impossible situations. You have the public health impacts and dealing with them are expensive. You have economic impacts if you're controlling the public health impacts. And we just talked about that collective action, but that has real economic impacts and the choices that you have to make. Those also have financial impacts that then have impacts on your budget. So this is a, you know, crisis that just keeps giving and giving, and there are going to have to be choices and trade-offs, and whether it's transportation, education, a whole number of other things, until and unless the federal government commits to a relief package that mitigates the blow to state and local government, we'll be making these trade-offs. And even then, there's not an unlimited source of funds, even at the federal government, which can run deficits. There are some hard choices ahead.
Listeners, is it time to raise revenue on the T? Would you do that? How reliant are you on your T service, and what could it mean for you to have it cut? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to play some sound here. This is Mella Miles, who is the director of the Transit-Oriented Development and the T Riders Union at Alternatives for Community Environment. She was with us on Tuesday, and she talked about who's really going to get hit the hardest if these proposed changes go through.
No one's on a bus just because they want to be on a bus in the middle of a pandemic. They're not out for a field trip. This is a lifeline to get to work, to go to their doctor's appointment, school, wherever else they need to get to. And the other folks, the people who are also on there may be undocumented. There are frontline workers. There are cleaners, those people who are cleaning up after us and trying to keep us safe.
So, Callum, the T says these cuts are data-driven, that they had equity in mind. But if you need the T to get to work and you don't have it, you don't have anything else. If you don't have an alternate other than public transportation and you lose it, is equity even possible?
I mean, frankly, no. And this is such an important issue. I was discussing this over the weekend with Michelle Wu, the Boston city councilor, who's also running for mayor. And, you know, we were talking about the sort of chicken and egg dilemma that you have here, right? And so it was here Steve Poftak say, well, we just don't have enough riders to sustain this level of service. But at the same time, if that level of service is there, people will stop. People who have a choice will stop. You know, in my, I used to take the commuter rail every day, Tiziana, to come into the studio. And if we come back and there isn't, you know, frequent a peak service, well, I'll just drive, right? I'll give up. But that's because I have the privilege of having that option. And what Michelle Wu pointed out to me was there are a lot of people in and around Boston who don't have that option, who don't own a car, and they're going to be stranded without any other option. And I think that is one of the real tragedies of these cuts.
Jane, I've heard a lot of skepticism on our air and in other reporting about the argument that these cuts are temporary. I want to play Jared Johnson here. He's the chief operating officer of Transit Matters. He was also with us on Tuesday, and he talked about the likelihood you could scale something back up once you cut it.
The general manager said these cuts are not permanent, and they spent some time talking about building back. But you don't turn on service like a tap. It's not just, oh, you know, we've got some few more people riding the train today. Now let's get some more operators. You know, these operators, it takes months, sometimes over a year, to train these bus operators, these motor personnel, and these engineers for the commuter rail train. So this is not something that we're going to just recover from.
And I was kind of thinking about that. You know, if you cut something and then you want to bring it back, it essentially it's like new spending. It's not like restoring something old. We have a problem with new spending. We were just talking about that. So is Jared right?
So he's right that you can't just stand it up, but the savings are real until such time as you bring it back. But I don't want to pick on Callum, who I have already, you know, called governor, so I'm being nice to him too. But
that was a great start, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a good start. It may go downhill here, Callum. But he's a great example, and he's right. He has privilege. I have privilege. So I didn't take the T because it doesn't go to Williamstown. I was coming into Boston, most weeks. I think we have not even begun to comprehend some of the historic disruptions in travel patterns, in commuter patterns. And so we have to deal with some of the fundamental short-term issues, financial, and absolutely in the most equitable way that we can. But there's also going to be a lot of realignment. There are a lot of individuals. None of us sort of love Zoom, although some of the filters are kind of nice on a bad day. But, you know, I love not getting on airplanes. There are some meetings that I used to drive all the way into Boston, 3 hours each way. That wasn't great for the environment. It wasn't, you know, the best use of time and productivity. There may be ways that we conduct business in the future. And some of the, you know, not everybody is me who always had to drive it. Some may be Callum's, right? He may, in the end, not come into Boston every day. WBUR may decide that, you know, they've invested in Opal and now they can do 3 days a week or whatever it is. So I think that the larger issue is going to be, what do those travel patterns become for all of us over time? And then what's the scale? How do we serve the people who need it most? What's the best way to do that? And that is a sort of reimagining that's going to happen in so many industries and so many services.
Okay, for the record, I would like to go back to seeing Callum every day, actually. But I hear you. I'm going to take a last call here. We've got Martha in Hingham. Martha, go ahead.
Hi. Just raising the question about the MBTA's moral responsibility. We have a community of 1,500 new residents at the Hingham Shipyard who are living in some $600 million of new investment by various developers who created their units because of the ferry, but they're proposing to remove the ferries altogether. Doesn't the MBTA have a responsibility to transit-oriented development such as this to continue public service?
All right, thanks for that question, Martha. Callum, 30 seconds or so before we go to Hub Hubs. What's your thought on Martha's question there?
I think it's a great question, and I think it's both for residential and commercial real estate, for example. You know, one of the things we've been talking about and thinking about is what is this pandemic going to do to the value of real estate, whether it's, you know, businesses working more remotely and needing less office space, or housing and other commercial developments that were constructed with, you know, public transit in mind, and then maybe that service or ridership goes way down. It's a big problem that we have to wrestle with in the coming years.
All right. I'm glad that we got that last little call in. Thank you, Martha. But before we go, I do want to leave time for our hubbubs. Those are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Jane, did you bring us one?
I did. So I put it up on Twitter as well, as I did the CDC link to workplace guidance. But the Major League Baseball has appointed its first ever female general manager. The Marlins have hired Kim, I hope I'm not butchering her name, Kim Ung, as general manager. She is both the first woman and the first Asian-American general manager in MLB history. The only reason I'm upset about that is I thought my daughter Elizabeth Hunt was going to be the first Major League Baseball general manager in history.
Well, I am a baseball fan, and I didn't know about that one. That is good news. And listen, just quickly before we go to Callum, Jane, we will also put that link to the CDC guidance on our website at radioboston.org. All right, Callum, you are up. Do you have a hubbub for us today?
Yeah, I want to stay in-house. Some of our loyal listeners may have heard the news yesterday that our own Bob Oakes is going to, in the coming months, be transitioning out of the host chair on Morning Edition. Of course, he's been there for 27 years, and I just want to mention it again now because I am one of those listeners, Tiziana, who grew up listening to him every morning. We had one of those, you know, under-the-cabinet radios in the kitchen, and my father and I would listen every morning, and I will share a story. I told Bob that yesterday when we were talking about it, and he said, you know, I've collected over the years pictures that the children of listeners have sent to me as fan mail, in which they imagine what this voice, Bob Oakes, that they hear looks like. And he says some of the illustrations include a dinosaur and a duck. Those are some of his favorites, and he's held on to them. And so I just want to let people know, if you're one of those listeners out there who years ago as a child sent Bob Oakes a crayon duck or dinosaur, he still has it, folks, and it is one of the things that he has appreciated over all these years.
And God, thank you for reminding us about this announcement yesterday, Callum. I mean, Bob's been part of my Boston mornings for 26 years, and I just don't know what I'm going to do without him. But I'm happy for him. He's going to get to do some reporting he wants to do. Also, Jane, I have a note from Chris Siderick. We check the score with him regularly. He says she's actually the first in North American professional sports. So a very big deal there. All right, so I'm just mine super fast. We have turkey terror. There are turkeys on the attack, it seems, everywhere, including, according to Boston.com, one attacking a woman at a Dunkin' Donuts this week. I just got to say, what is more Massachusetts 2020 than 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, turkeys attacking people outside Dunkin' Donuts in Greater Boston? You're welcome. All right, former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift and WBUR's Callum Borchers, thanks to both of you for joining us for Week in Review.
Thank you.
Always fun.